From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. David Brinkley is one of TV's most distinguished journalists. He started his career before there was TV news. On today's Fresh Air, Brinkley talks about his long career in journalism, from his early days covering the FDR White House to his current program analyzing the latest scandal every Sunday morning. Also today, Jill Kirk-Conway tells us about growing up in the isolation of the Australian outback. Her early schooling was through correspondence courses, but she later became the president of Smith College. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new reissue featuring organist Big John Patton, recorded in the 1960s. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new season of Public TV's quirky comedy series, Trying Times. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. It was anything but a nightmare on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average regained almost half of Friday's big drop, and after tumbling in first hour of trading, the Dow shot upward, finishing 88 points higher than Friday's close at 2657.38. Secretary of State James Baker expressing his deep concern that Nicaraguan Contra rebels in Honduras will be forced to return to Nicaragua without adequate guarantees for their safety, and NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
In a letter to United Nations Secretary General Javier Pérez de Cuellar, Baker objects to remarks made by a high-ranking UN official last week. The official reportedly told the Contras to give up their cause and return to Nicaragua. Baker says the Contras are unlikely to do that voluntarily as long as they face recrimination from the Sandinista government. Here's the State Department's Margaret Tutwiler.
The political and security situation in Nicaragua must improve and accommodate resistance concerns before they can be expected to voluntarily demobilize and repatriate.
UN officials have already tried to distance themselves from the remarks made to the Contras. In a related development, Tutwiler also confirmed that some Contras have sold their U.S.-supplied weapons to the rebels in El Salvador. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Police in Washington today arrested 55 protesters after they blocked the entrance to a House office building, disrupted a House session, and staged demonstrations in two congressional offices to protest U.S. military aid to El Salvador. But about 200 demonstrators rallied outside the Capitol, then marched to the Rayburn office building, carrying banners denouncing right-wing death squads as well as American aid. In Dallas, a special hearing for a state district court judge accused of anti-gay bias drew a courthouse protest. Tom Olson of member station KERA in Dallas has details.
Protesters carrying two wood coffins marched in front of the Dallas County Courthouse, calling for the ouster of Judge Jack Hampton, who touched off a furor almost a year ago by suggesting he may have given a lighter sentence to a double execution-style killer because the two murder victims were gay. In post-trial news interviews, Judge Hampton called the victims queers cruising the streets asking for trouble. In a two-hour hearing today, defenders called Judge Hampton a fair, unbiased, God-fearing family man, claimed it wasn't what the judge said, but just a poor choice of words, and blamed the news media for sensationalism in drawing attention to the case. The State Commission on Judicial Conduct is expected to rule by year's end. For National Public Radio, I'm Tom Olson in Dallas.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 88 points to close at 2657.38. It was the fifth busiest day on Wall Street. 418 million shares changed hands. The average price of a share gained 81 cents. This is NPR News. The White House prepared an order for President Bush to sign today, cutting $16 billion from the federal budget that Congress has been unable to cut on its own. Budget Chief Richard Darman pointed out the president's action is required by law. The only hope for averting the cuts imposed automatically by the Graham-Rudman balanced budget law is for the House and Senate to agree to a compromise budget-cutting bill and send it to Bush for his signature by midnight, and that is unlikely. A bizarre new twist in the tangled political life of Boris Yeltsin, the maverick communist ousted from the Soviet Politburo. The Soviet Interior Minister said today Yeltsin reported an attack by would-be assassins late last month, but investigators found no evidence to back up the charge. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
In a dramatic speech to the Soviet legislature today, Interior Minister Vadim Bakhatin said Yeltsin told authorities his assailants abducted him, pulled a bag over his head, and threw him from a bridge into the Moscow River. According to Bakhatin, Yeltsin later told authorities that he managed to swim to the riverbank. After Bakhatin's presentation, Yeltsin himself told his colleagues in the legislature that there had been no attack. His brief comments today are not likely to satisfy Yeltsin's loyal followers, many of whom see his flamboyant populism as a possible political alternative to Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
A car bomb exploded today in a northeastern Colombian city and killed four employees of the Vanguardia liberal newspaper, which has joined in the condemnation of cocaine barons. The newspaper's publisher blamed drug traffickers for the bombing that wrecked his building in a city 175 miles north of Bogota. He said he did not know whether the paper would continue to publish. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As David Brinkley has pointed out, he started doing TV news before anyone was watching. And when he stopped anchoring in 1979, he said that he'd done the news longer than anyone else on Earth. Brinkley started his broadcasting career at NBC in 1943. From 1956 to 1970, the name of Brinkley was usually paired with Huntley. It was the Huntley-Brinkley Report that made Brinkley one of TV's first celebrated anchors. After Chet Huntley retired, Brinkley co-anchored the NBC News with John Chancellor, then became a commentator. In 1981, he joined ABC, where he began the still-popular Sunday morning program This Week with David Brinkley. The paperback edition of Brinkley's book, Washington Goes to War, is now on the bestseller list. Brinkley describes it as a chronicle of how World War II transformed Washington from a small provincial town into the capital of the free world. Brinkley remembers what Washington was like when he first moved there in 1943.
The war had begun, of course, but it was still essentially a country town, slow-moving. People in Washington who had big business activities went to Baltimore to borrow money, because that's where the big banks were. People read the Baltimore Sun more than they read any Washington paper, because at that time we didn't have a really good paper. There were no restaurants to speak of. There was no theater to speak of. There was not much of anything to speak of. It was a sort of a fried-in-grease town.
How big was the press corps?
Not very. Nothing like what it is today. I would say, I don't really know the answer, but I would guess a few hundred.
Oh, that's pretty small.
It's in the thousands. It's in the thousands now.
Now, you were the White House correspondent, weren't you, for, was it NBC Radio?
NBC, well, that's radio was all it was then.
Right, okay. So, listen, I figure it must have not been considered a very important beat if such a young man or someone still really a rookie was assigned to the White House in the
early
40s.
Well, partly because I got out of the Army early, and everybody was crying for male help. Female help was not as welcome then as it is now. All kinds of changes have taken place. And the White House was not really a full-time beat. The president had press conferences twice a week, one on Tuesday morning and one on Thursday afternoon. I may have those reversed, because they were intended only for newspapers. And reporters showed up at the appointed hour, went to the press conference, and left. And there were only five or six who were there all day, and there was no reason to be there all day because not much was happening. There was no such thing as a leak at that time.
So that was the White House beat, huh? You just covered
pretty much. You showed up twice a week for the press conference and left.
You point out that radio became a medium that was taken seriously as a news medium during World War II. Did you take radio very seriously when you were working in it? Did you think of it as the place you wanted to continue to work? And again, this was before television.
I did take it very seriously. I thought it was terribly important during the war more than ever before. People stayed glued to the radios because we had tremendous amounts of news. And I remember putting on all kinds of things during the war that the newspapers would not have until the next morning. And there were people all over the country who kept the radio on all day long and had a map. And they put pins in the map to keep track of activity on the war fronts as the radio reported them. And we had some very, very good reporters in those days reporting the war from the war fronts. I never did that. And so radio became a very serious and highly respected news medium.
Now, I learned from your new book that NBC used to insist that after 6 in the evening, men had to wear formal attire and black tie. How long did that regulation last, and what was the rationale for it?
Well, the rationale was that NBC wanted to be considered what it was for a long time, the foremost radio network. It was a serious enterprise. Everything on the air was live, everything. There was not even a recorded commercial. Everything was live. And they wanted to maintain a high degree of dignity and seriousness and public acceptance, and so in the photographs of radio performers at night, Fred Allen, big names in those years, all wore black tie. The announcers wore black tie. Everyone wore black tie.
Of course, no one listening to the radio could see them.
I know that. But,
yes, somehow you know that, yeah.
Somehow it had an effect on they thought it had an effect on the performance of their people.
Did you buy that yourself?
Well, I don't know. I didn't own the network, and if that's what they wanted, it was okay with me. It didn't matter.
Did you have to keep a change of clothes with you, so if you had a report after 6, you'd have your formal attire?
Yes. Yes. They stopped that eventually. I don't remember exactly what year they stopped it, but they did stop it. I think when television came along, they dropped it.
Now, was that sense of formality carried over into The Voice as well? Were you expected to sound very formal, especially in the evening hours?
Well, people in radio at that time took their diction and their speech patterns very, very seriously. I remember announcers saying in tones of awe that, what's his name, who used to announce a Metropolitan Opera broadcast, Milton Cross, was he Milton
yeah,
Cross?
Yeah,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
Milton Cross. They spoke of him as if he were some kind of deity because he had won a prize for having the finest diction in radio. It was good.
Now, you really have perhaps the most consciously or unconsciously imitated voice in broadcasting. How was your voice regarded when you first started working in radio? Were you considered to have a good radio voice?
I don't know that anybody paid any attention. I never heard anything about it or never thought anything about it. I don't know. I can't answer that.
Mm-hmm. I know that there were many preachers in your family, and I was wondering if they're... style of oratory affected you at all?
Because I never went to hear them.
Oh, really?
No, they were. This is before my time. There was a line of Presbyterian preachers in my background, but by the time I was old enough to go to church, and I can't say that I went, even though I was old enough very often, they were all gone.
When did you first become aware that other people in broadcasting were picking up your inflections?
I guess the first time was when somebody ran an ad in Variety, the little show business newspaper, weekly newspaper, ran an ad in Variety offering $1,500 for somebody who could record a commercial for 1 minute using my speech pattern. And the joke at the time was that I applied for it and was turned down, which is, of course, not true, but that was the joke. I don't know anymore. I shouldn't tell this because I don't know what finally happened.
David Brinkley is my guest. Well, while we're talking about your voice, let's talk a little bit about writing. You've been praised so much for knowing how to write a simple declarative sentence and for writing really clear, concise copy for television. How did you develop your style of writing for radio and TV?
Well, I worked for United Press, which at that time had what it called a radio wire. I guess it still has it. It goes only to radio stations, and they thought I could write well, so they put me to work writing for the radio wire. And it attracted some attention because it was pretty good, I guess, and NBC hired me as a writer to write news scripts for announcers to read, which is how the news was done then. And one reason I learned to write clearly and simply was that I had to write in such a way that the announcers, who knew nothing of what they were reading, that the announcers could not read it wrongly. And so they would emphasize the right word and not change the meaning of the sentence by emphasizing a wrong word.
Would you ever let anyone write for you? Did anyone ever write for you in your years of anchoring?
No.
Did you ever try it and have a bad experience?
No. Well, I a time or two, for whatever reason, I had to read something because something happened while I was on the air. I had to read copy written by someone else, and I found I simply could not do it. I can't do it.
Well, why not?
I don't know. I just can't. I'm used to reading my own, saying my own words, and I cannot say somebody else's.
When you say you cannot say it, does that mean that you trip over the words?
It means that I gobble it all up. So what I would have always had to do, this hadn't happened much. When it did happen, I first had to read it and then ad-lib it.
Uh-huh.
I can't read other people's copy.
Does that have to do more with not liking other people's writing or more with needing sentences that fit your inflections?
The second, needing sentences that fit my inflections. I can't read other people's sentences. I simply can't.
Mm-hmm. Now, something else that you did as a writer and as an anchor was to allow an element of irony and detachment. Were you ever criticized for that early on before it became recognized as your style?
I think I probably was, yes.
Do you remember exactly for what reasons?
For that reason, that I was ironic and sounded detached, and some critics wrote that, and if I were asked how I reacted, the answer is I didn't.
What about executives? Did they criticize you?
The executives, generally speaking, didn't know a cliché from third base. They wouldn't have known it anyway. The executives in radio, when I was in radio, really didn't know much about it, didn't much about news. What they knew about was soap operas and Fred Allen and Charlie McCarthy and so on. They didn't know anything about news.
What about in television, though, when you were ironic and somewhat detached in your readings?
Well, by that time, I think we'd all grown up, and they knew who I was and what I was, and I knew I wasn't going to change and couldn't if I wanted to, so no one ever complained about it. The only complaints I've ever heard have been from critics in print, mm-hmm. newspapers and so on. Mm-hmm. And very little of it, but it has been there.
Well, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is David Brinkley. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
David Brinkley is my guest. You've said that you learned to do TV before anyone was watching, and I guess that's pretty true. And by 1950, you were doing regular reports on the, what was it called, the Camel News Caravan?
John Cameron Swayze and the Camel News Caravan. It was perfectly awful, Terry.
Why was it awful?
Well, partly because when one set out to do a television news program at that time, there was no a history to go by. No one knew how to do it. It had never been done before. And you are not old enough to remember, but in the past, there were, in the movie theaters, newsreels between the features. And they were perfectly awful. They were owned by the movie studios, and mainly they used them to clear out the theater between features so people wouldn't sit through them twice. And there were dull, boring, silly stories about ship launchings, horse races, fashion shows, and so on. So when television came along and decided to do news, they didn't know what to do except to copy the newsreels, which is what they did. And the Swayze program, which I did do a little bit of, was, as I say, perfectly awful. It was ship launchings and fashion shows and other kinds of junk. No news, really. Not much.
Well, this was before there were rules about what made good television, and I would think that would leave you free to take certain risks and experiment a little.
Free to, but not really able to, because the facilities were so bad. The film was black and white. The sound was optical sound, very poor. It took forever to get film processed, and forever beyond that to get it edited. When it came from out of the city, New York or Washington, it had to be flown in and very often got lost at the airport. It was really a mess. So all we did was struggle and try to get something on the air, and that's about all we accomplished.
Well, in 1956, you became the co-anchor of the NBC News with Chet Huntley, mm-hmm. the Huntley-Brinkley Report. Was anchoring at that time considered a real high-prestige position in the way that it's subsequently been seen?
Nothing like it has come to be since then. It was then thought of as a kind of interesting job. There weren't any real anchors before that. There was John Cameron Swayze, and on CBS along later came Doug Edwards. And on ABC, I don't think they were in the game yet. So there wasn't much. Anchoring didn't amount to much. There wasn't much to anchor. The programs are 15 minutes long. The pictures are bad. The sound was bad. Very few people had television sets. And so it didn't really amount to much. It later came to be what it is. Whatever that is, I'm not sure I know.
Do you mind me asking a question? I know you've been asked a million times. But about how you were paired with Chet Huntley.
NBC thought at that time, the big name, biggest name in news at that time prior to that was Ed Murrow. And every network felt it had to have an Ed Murrow or somebody who sounded like him. NBC hired Chet Huntley thinking he sounded like Ed Murrow. And he was in New York and I was in Washington. For the first time, they'd resolved to cover a political convention thoroughly, because finally we had some cameras and so on, were able to do it. And they were unwilling to trust either of us alone, and so they put the two of us together, thinking that if one of us screwed up, the other could save him. There have been many arguments about who was responsible for that decision, but somebody in New York made it, and we did do the 1956 convention together. And it worked very well, and it led to the Huntley-Brinkley news report in fall of 56.
Now, I understand that you really didn't like the famous sign-off that you used every night.
I didn't.
Good night, Chet. Good night, David. Why not? It doesn't seem very offensive.
Well, it seemed silly to me. It seemed that when we said good night, we should say good night to the audience. We are there to tell them the news, not to tell each other. We're there. And I didn't think it sounded too good, two men saying good night to each other on the air. We should say good night to the audience. And I fought and argued and fought and argued and lost. The producer insisted that we say good night, Chet, and good night, David. So finally we gave in, and we did, and it became, for a long time, part of the language.
Since it caught on, do you think that you were wrong, or do you think that you were right?
Well, I don't know who's to say, but it caught on, and so I couldn't argue anymore.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were first paired to cover a convention together, and you've said that you have always really liked covering conventions. You've thought of them as kind of big parties, big games, a lot of excitement. I was wondering what you felt at the Chicago convention, in the Democratic convention in 1968.
68?
Yeah.
I felt I was in a foreign country. I was shocked by what was happening out there in the streets. Students being beaten by the police. The mayor of Chicago turning out the sewer workers to fill up the auditorium to cheer him and to hold up signs saying, "We love Mayor Daley." It truly was shocking and somewhat frightening. I remember that was at about the time when the Russians had gone into Czechoslovakia to shut down the democratic movement there under Dubček. And I remember saying on the air, "Are we in the United States or are we in Czechoslovakia?" Well, the mayor, needless to say, didn't like that, but it was true. I was shocked by it and infuriated by it.
Now, did you get any flack for saying that? Are we in the United States or are we in Czechoslovakia?
I got some flack from Mayor Daley, but not much from anybody else. I think everybody else outside of Chicago was shocked at what happened there.
Mm-hmm. David Brinkley is my guest. He hosts This Week with David Brinkley, a Sunday morning program which analyzes the events of the week. Let me ask you this. The two people who I assume are supposed to be political balance to each other are George Will as the conservative and Sam Donaldson as the liberal. But it always seems to me that George Will is further to the right than Sam Donaldson is to the left. And I was wondering if you think of them as an equal balance.
I don't really think of it in those terms, Terry. I don't think political opinion can be measured by some kind of micrometer. What you say may well be true, but if asked to prove it, I would have a hard time doing it. George is quite conservative, and Sam is sort of liberal. He's not a red-hot, screaming left-winger, but he's sort of liberal. And he very often disagrees with George, and I'm delighted. Otherwise, we would miss a lot of chances for opinions to be exposed and discussed, because everybody agreed. It'd make a fairly boring program, actually.
Where do you think of yourself as falling in the political spectrum?
I have spent my entire working life avoiding any political label.
Mm-hmm.
The only answer I can give you is that depending on what it is, I am either a liberal or a conservative. That's no answer, I know, but I can't give you an answer. It depends on what the question is.
Mm-hmm. When people come on your show on Sunday morning, I'm sure they come on determined to just say what it is that they've decided to say beforehand, and then it's your job and the jobs of the other people on the show to try to get them to go beyond what they've prepared in advance. Is that very difficult to do, and do you think of yourself or as the other people on the program as having certain techniques of pushing people further than they planned to go?
Yes, everything you say is true. Everyone we have on the air, usually it's some sort of political figure or an academic figure or some sort of intellectual figure. Every one of them will arrive in a studio with some little sermonette in mind and determined to deliver it. So one thing I do is first ask them a dull, boring question like, what do you think about this? And let them deliver their little sermonette. And then we get to the hardcore of what we're there to talk about. Let them get it out of their system before they will go into anything else.
That sermonette can be kind of long. How do you make sure it's a concise sermonette?
Interrupt. Uh-huh. I don't let them run on all night.
Uh-huh.
They do that before they come, and if they try to go into a filibuster, I had one not long ago, one from the SNL industry who wanted to filibuster, and I stopped him. I cut him off. I do it politely, but we do it.
You started on television before there was videotape, so you couldn't watch a tape-delayed broadcast of your show. You couldn't watch the videotape and see how you were doing. Do you remember the first time you actually watched yourself on videotape, what the experience was like?
I remember I didn't like it. And I didn't like how I looked and sounded, didn't like anything about it, and I've almost never looked at myself since. I'm serious. I mean that. Our Sunday program at 10:30 is done live. At 11:30, we play back the tape to the West Coast and so on. I could easily sit and watch it all. I never, ever watch it.
And why not?
I don't want to look at myself. I don't know why not. Maybe I'm crazy.
But do you ever think, well, you should overcome that feeling so you could see the show and critique it and see if there's anything you wanted to change? Or...
Well, since I was on it, I know what is on the program,
right.
And I know what
okay.
I think was pretty good and what I think was less than good, and so I don't really need to do that to critique it. But as for looking at myself, it really doesn't appeal to me, mm-hmm. and I don't do it. I truly almost never have done it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about the news and about your broadcasting career. Thank you very much for your time.
Terry, thank you. I've enjoyed being with you.
David Brinkley. You can see him Sunday mornings on This Week with David Brinkley. His book, Washington Goes to War, is on the bestseller list. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, we talk with Arthur Baker, a record producer who helped create the hip-hop sound of the 80s. He has a new record with a band he put together. Several different singers are featured, including Al Green. This is Al Green's track. It was produced and co-written by Arthur Baker.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As a small child on an isolated Australian ranch, Jill Kirkconway began her education through correspondence courses. Years later, she became the first woman president of Smith College. Coming up, Jill Kirkconway talks about coming of age as a feminist, despite growing up with the macho code of the outback. In the 1960s, Big John Patton made a series of jazz organ records, but then he dropped from sight for a decade, reappearing in recent years in John Zorn's band. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews one of Patton's early records, newly reissued on CD. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the second season of the PBS series Trying Times. It's a collection of comedies about contemporary life. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. There were impressive gains in trading on Wall Street today as the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 88 points to close at 2,657.38. Volume was extremely heavy. NPR's Barbara Mantell reports from New York.
Investors, analysts, and government regulators were concerned that the panic selling of last Friday, when the Dow average plunged nearly 191 points, or 7%, would continue through today. And initially this morning, selling was strong, with the Dow dropping 64 points in the first hour of trading. But soon, bargain hunters stepped into the market, buying stocks that suddenly looked cheap, and the Dow average quickly began to recover. Several large investment firms also recommended that their clients take the opportunity to purchase stocks, and the Federal Reserve Board stepped in to reassure the markets by injecting cash into the banking system. In New York, I'm Barbara Mantell reporting.
President Bush is about to sign an order cutting over $16 billion from the federal budget, something which so far Congress has failed to do on its own. The only chance for averting the cuts imposed automatically by the Graham-Rudman balanced budget law is for the House and Senate to agree to a compromise budget-cutting bill and send it to the president for his signature by midnight. Lawmakers have said for weeks that they plan to roll back the cuts as soon as they agree to a compromise on a deficit-cutting bill. The space shuttle Atlantis is set for liftoff tomorrow, shortly before 1 p.m. Eastern Time. It will be carrying the Galileo probe, which will start a six-year voyage to Jupiter. NPR's Michael Schuller reports that the countdown is finally proceeding smoothly.
Last week, the shuttle mission ran into a series of obstacles. First, there was a legal challenge from groups protesting the nuclear batteries aboard Galileo. A federal judge ruled the launch could go ahead, but then a problem with the main engine computer on the shuttle forced a five-day delay. Then a Florida citizens group vowed to enter the launch pad and stop the mission. Seven protesters were arrested today trying to enter a security gate near the pad, but even that threat has disappeared. The group now says it will not disrupt tomorrow's launch, claiming it doesn't want to put its members at risk in case there is a shuttle accident. NASA officials say there is little risk of a radioactive spill, even if there is a shuttle disaster. The countdown continues, and forecasters say there's an 80% chance conditions will be fine for the launch at 12:57 p.m. Eastern Time. This is Michael Schuller at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
For the second time in over 20 years, North and South Korea have reached tentative agreement on allowing visits between divided families, but there are still terms to be agreed upon. And repeating, on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 88 points to close at 2,657.38 in extremely heavy trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Organist Big John Patton made a series of albums for the Blue Note label in the 1960s that marked him as one of the more progressive jazz organ players. After his last album for the label in 1969, Patton dropped out of sight. Recently, he's returned to recording, both in traditional organ groups and the more radical units led by composer John Zorn. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of the long-delayed Patton album that put the organist back on the map.
John Patton was a forgotten figure in jazz until his 1963 record, Blue John, was first released in 1986, 23 years behind schedule. His only recent album before that was on a small independent label. Since then, he's turned up on several records, notably John Zorn's fine album called Spillane. Blue John was recently issued on CD for the first time. It's the only one of the 9 albums Patton made for the Blue Note label in the 60s, which is currently available. It's a fascinating album that shows how perceptions of a work of art can change depending on its historical context. John Patton had worked as a pianist for R&B singer Lloyd Price before taking up jazz organ. On Blue John, his pop roots give themselves away. The tune Hot Sauce by saxophonist George Braith echoes great early 60s dance crazes like the limbo and the twist. On guitar is the organ group picker extraordinaire Grant Green. That music is mindlessly repetitive enough to sound intellectual, lowbrow stuff that anticipates highbrow minimalism. Terry Riley's groundbreaking minimal work, In C, was composed in 1964, a year after Blue John was recorded. As the jazz and classical composer Anthony Davis has pointed out, minimalism wouldn't be possible without rhythm and blues. He's right. Minimalism has its roots in the propulsive riffing of Kansas City swing bands, as well as in shimmering Indonesian gamelans and driving African drum choirs. John Patton's Blue John is one of the most minimal jazz records ever made. That may be why it wasn't released when it was fresh. It sounded too stripped down. When Patton hits a groove like that, it's not hard to hear a link between his stuff and the organ music of Philip Glass. Patton's proto-minimalism is intensified by saxophonist George Braith, who'd blow two horns in parallel motion at the same time. He called his two saxes braced together the Braithophone. John Patton isn't merely a minimalist. While he's carving out riffs or spinning melodies with his hands, he's also pumping out bass lines with his feet on pedals laid out like a giant keyboard. He plays nice walking bass on Grant Green's Dem Dirty Dudes. We'll be right back. The album Blue John is not John Patton's only recent appearance on record. He's also on a new album by guitarist Jimmy Ponder, Jump, on the Muse label. But that's a more typical soul jazz date, where Patton sounds like a typical jazz organ player. The nice thing about Blue John is that it's plain enough to be really weird.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Big John Patton's album Blue John on Blue Note. This is Fresh Air. Feminist historian Jill Kirk-Conway was the first woman president of Smith College. That's a long way from the sheep station in New South Wales, Australia, where she grew up. In 1960, when she was 25, Conway left Australia for graduate school in the United States. Conway recounts her childhood in the outback and the years leading up to her departure for the U.S. in her memoir, The Road from Kurrain. Kurrain was the name of her father's 30,000-acre ranch. I wanted to have a sense of the place where Conway was from, so I asked her to describe the landscape.
Oh, yes, with pleasure. If you look at a map of Australia and draw a line 500 miles due west of Sydney, you come to an area that is just empty. If it's a map that shows climate, it will show less than 10 inches annual rainfall. It is totally devoid of trees, except where there's a submerged stream that produces a few straggly clumps of trees. Absolutely flat, very beautiful in colors, wonderful scarlet soil, and usually grass that is burnt to a beautiful gold and silver color by the heat of the sun, and an enormous sky.
So you grew up in a very isolated setting.
Totally. Our next-door neighbors were, about 50 miles away on one side about 20 miles another and 10 or 12 in another direction.
Your first schooling was through a correspondence course.
Yes, it was. My mother thought I could do two years in one, and she told the correspondence school that, but they thought there were two children on the place, so they sent the first lesson of the first grade and the first lesson of the second grade. And continued in installments all the way through the year. It wasn't clear to me that it was work of a different degree of difficulty, so we didn't know until the end of the year.
I love what you say about studying alone in isolation, that you were introduced to study as a leisure time activity. It sounds like you never really grew to dislike education in the way that so many children who go to schools do.
Well, I think that's true. You know, so much time is taken in school with getting children to sit down at the same time or stand up at the same time or concentrate on the same thing. And for me, it was sheer pleasure. I was doing hard physical labor on the sheep station, and I worked at that 4 days a week. And on the fifth day, on Friday, I got to sit down and do my school, and it was such a treat because I'd be given my own pot of tea, and my Friday was a baking day, so there would be great smells of fresh baked scones and cookies coming from the kitchen, and I felt totally indulged, and I've never felt about learning any other way.
Were you sure that you would go to college?
It was very clear in my family, because my mother was such a feminist, that I would. And interestingly, the stereotypes of gender worked in my favor in my family, because it was expected that my brothers would probably not go to university, and would, since our father was a rancher, that they would take up life on the land too, and that meant that they would begin that right after school.
You went to the University of Sydney first, yes?
Yes, I did.
And then you thought about what to do next. You decided you didn't want to go to school in England because you'd feel like a colonial there. You applied to Harvard and started living in the United States. Did you find that there were more opportunities for women?
Oh, goodness, yes. Well, I arrived at the Harvard Graduate School I lived in the graduate residence where there were several hundred other women all getting PhDs and all enormously bright and interesting people drawn from all over the world. And I found a director of my graduate studies who regularly told his students that the contribution of women to American intellectual life was as important as men's, and handed out lists of women whose lives needed to be studied and whose intellectual histories needed to be written and so forth. That was just a new world for me.
What set you in the direction of being a college administrator, first a vice president at the University of Toronto, then the first woman president at Smith?
Well, I was a woman who had the good fortune, I think, to be born at the right time. I was just finished my PhD and beginning life as a professional historian just at the point when there was an enormous expansion of higher education in the United States and Canada. And I went to Canada with my husband, who was taking part in planning and building a new university in Toronto. And myself joined the history department at the University of Toronto. And in the process, I suddenly discovered one day that although I had joined the history department at the University of Toronto with a group of young men, all trained in American doctoral programs like me, I was the only one who wasn't being promoted, and I found that I was also being quite severely discriminated against in my salary. And so I just got in a rage and went and confronted the department chairman and the dean with this information. And they very quickly rectified the situation. But when I was finished, I realized that there were loads of other women faculty who had parents or children to support and were in much more jeopardy protesting such things than I. So I began organizing the women faculty. And before I knew it, I was in a leadership role that I just stumbled into. And very shortly thereafter, there was a change in the university administration, and I sort of had to put up or shut up, and so I accepted a position as one of the university vice presidents. And so I sort of backed into it and then found out I really loved it.
Mm-hmm. You spent 10 years
yes.
as the president of Smith College.
Yes.
The first woman president of Smith
yes,
College, which is
right.
a women's school. Now that women are admitted to top colleges around the country, do you think that there still is a need for women's colleges?
Oh, absolutely. First of all, you have to remember that women's colleges in this country are probably the only ones that have a consistent record of having co-educational faculties. They're usually roughly 50-50, and most of the institutions that are co-educational in their student bodies have a long way to go in terms of equal recruitment of women faculty and administrators. One learns to take one's place as an intellect and a politically active person in a society in which all the roles of leadership are open to women. And once you learn that and internalize it, you're never phased again. And then there's an enormous advantage to a woman from moving from late adolescence to young adulthood in a setting where there are very strong female models around her, so that she doesn't experience her working self and her generative self as in any conflict, but the one affirming the other. And intellectually, women's colleges are still utopias in which women's experience is taken seriously and not seen as somehow or other to be assimilated to men's or deviant if it doesn't match.
Did you ever go through days where you'd think to yourself, how did I end up the president of a college after all I started in this correspondence school?
Often. I must say, I think that I was very fortunate in that early education because it gave me a very strong sense that I could educate myself and learn any task that I set out on. And so I wasn't fazed by all the new skills I had to learn at different stages in life. But certainly I was often amused by that.
In your memoir, you describe a bit of the Bush ethic.
Yes.
This is living in the bush, not George mm-hmm. Bush, I should say, for anybody just tuning in.
Yes.
And you said that the Bush ethic made a virtue out of loneliness and hardship. And the idea was when disaster strikes, what matters is unflinching courage, the refusal to consider despair. Does that ethic in any way inform your attitude now?
Well, it does and it doesn't. I find that it is just ingrained in me to stiffen up and become stoic when faced with a challenge or real hardship or tragedy. But on the other hand, intellectually, I don't accept those stoic values, so I've taught myself to be emotionally much freer. But the training in just straightening the back and digging in the heels is very deep, and yeah, I still have it.
When was the last time you returned to Karain, the area where you grew up in?
I took my husband there about 4 years ago. He was absolutely overwhelmed by the isolation and the emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
The house where I grew up is now empty. The ranch is part of a much larger property. So that it was both very lovely to see that landscape again, and very poignant to see this world my parents had built, now in process of decay.
In the process of decay?
Yes, because the house isn't lived in any longer, and the garden, which I describe in my book, is gone. But as I also say, the land renews itself and is as beautiful as ever.
Well, I want to thank you very much for telling us a little bit about your life. Thank you.
A pleasure.
Jill Kirk-Conway teaches part-time at MIT and writes feminist history. Her memoir, The Road from Karain, is published by Knopf. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and Check In with Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We're going to be hearing today about what happened on Wall Street and why it happened. Also, a report from Jackie Leiden about a suit that's been brought by patients at the Montana State Mental Hospital. The patients charged the state with warehousing them and with mistreating them. We'll also talk to a woman who is a San Francisco Giants fan. You know how the Giants have done so far, I trust.
Not too well, yes.
Not too well. Well, she wasn't doing too well either. When her World Series tickets were mistakenly thrown into the garbage and taken away and put in the dump. She sifted through the garbage, and with odds against her about as long as they are against the Giants, she found them.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The PBS comedy anthology series Trying Times has returned to TV this season after a hiatus. Television critic David Bianculli has a review of some of the new episodes.
I always cringe a little whenever anybody says they're going to stretch the boundaries of TV by hiring writers and playwrights who don't usually have anything to do with TV. That's because the people who don't write for TV usually don't watch it. So when they do write for it, what they think is breaking new ground is actually rehashing old ideas. It happened when John Cheever adapted one of his own stories for American Playhouse and had this clever idea to insert fake commercials, something that Saturday Night Live had been doing for 5 years. It also happened when PBS first presented Trying Times, which had unusual characters and stories and no laugh track. That was supposed to be the exact opposite of what commercial network TV was doing, except that at the time, that's exactly what TV was doing, with Frank's Place, The Wonder Years, and The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. And compared to those shows, Trying Times wasn't cutting-edge comedy, it was dull. But in the 2 years it took for Trying Times to mount a second season of shows, most of the so-called dramedies disappeared from commercial TV, and Trying Times got a better batch of contributors. This year, Trying Times is worth watching. In this week's installment, Peter Riegert plays a suburban businessman who comes home to find his family and pets gone, and a beautiful spy, played by Gina Davis, in their place. She says her organization is concerned because his name has shown up on what they suspect is a hit list.
I'm right up there with Bishop Tutu, me, William S. Creeber.
I imagine you feel both humble and proud.
I do, Daphne, I do. Hey, there's an asterisk after my name.
That's what worries us.
The asterisk worries you?
The asterisk worries us a great deal.
Why?
We don't know the organization which originated this list. We don't, for example, know if they're far left or far right. But we do think it's a hit list, and we think that the asterisk after your name means they intend to hit you first.
Me first?
That's what we think.
My God, why me?
That's what I'm here to find out.
But the police should be in on this, or the FBI.
They scoff.
They scoff?
In a later episode, called The Boss, Gene Stapleton plays an elderly woman who goes to work at a fast food hamburger joint. Corey Feldman plays her very young, very hostile manager, and their scenes together are my favorite moments from this year's batch of Trying Times episodes.
Why is this cash register receipt messed up, huh? Look at this. It's all messed up. Why?
Oh, why ask me about it? It's all automatic. Ask the cash register.
Oh, no. I see what happened. You needed to change the tape.
Yes, I did.
Oh, no, you didn't. You didn't. Look, look. All the numbers are tiny and they're mashing together. Besides, as it is here, we haven't made any money. That's ridiculous. Look, there's stripes on them.
Don't blame the stripes of the world on me.
The list of actors, playwrights, and directors taking part in Trying Times is just as impressive as the last time around. Peter Scolari, Judge Reinhold, Stockard Channing, and Robert Klein star. Alan Arkin and Christopher Guest direct. And off-Broadway playwrights A.R. Gurney, Richard Greenberg, and others provide the scripts. And they're funny. Maybe during those 2 years off, everybody watched a little more TV than usual.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Arthur Baker, a record producer and master remixer who helped create the hip-hop sound of the 80s. And writer June Jordan talks about her efforts to make black English accepted English. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.